This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the world of Forbes, Barron's, and Fortune magazines. This is brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization. My name is Greg Conroy. So let's get down to business. Starting with Forbes magazine, The High Flyer. This was written by Zoya Hasen and Thomas Brewster. China makes 70% of the world's drones. Blake Resnick wants to change that. Backed by Sam Altman and Peter Thiel, the 25-year-old founder of Brink is on his way to make his quadcopters the top choice for America's cops, if only he can get the federal government to ban his primary competitor. A frantic woman makes a 911 call in the suburban town of Queen Creek, Arizona, southeast of Phoenix, claiming her boyfriend is trying to strangle her. After officers arrive on the scene, the suspect slips away. They launch a Brink responder drone, which locates him about 4 minutes later near a major roadway. When the cops catch up, he says he's armed and ready to shoot. The drone's camera zooms in. He's lying. There's no gun in sight. The officers safely approach and arrest him. The drone flies back to its nest, quote-unquote, a 5x5-foot charging dock on the police department's roof with white metal doors that snap shut like a mechanical Venus flytrap. Drones scoping out the scene of a crime is an increasingly common scenario in American policing. What is far less common is that they're made in America. DJI, the giant Chinese drone maker, controls 70% of the global market for government and commercial drones, per analyst estimates, worth some $18.6 billion in 2024. Over 80% of public safety organizations with a drone fleet use DJI devices, while only 7% use Brink's. But crucially for Brink and its 25-year-old founder, Blake Resnick, the responder is made in Seattle, not Shenzhen. Resnick's bet is that American police will soon be using American drones, whether by choice or by necessity. As of December 23rd, unless the NSA or another security agency vouches for DJI, its drones will be banned from future sale in the U.S., much to the chagrin of cops and first responders who tell Forbes the Chinese manufacturer's devices are cheaper, more reliable, and more technically advanced. One of DJI's most advanced police drones, the Matrice M30T, costs around $15,000. Brink's comparable responder starts at $20,000. Even Resnick admits, quote, DJI makes incredible products at very low prices, close quote. Where there's a national security concern, though, there's a business opportunity. Brink and Resnick have ridden the wave of America Firstism to a $480 million valuation after raising $157 million in funding from Motorola, London-based Index Ventures, and billionaires including Sam Altman, Peter Thiel, and Figma co-founder Dylan Field. Resnick isn't coy about his position in the geopolitical tussle. Quote, I don't think it's healthy that the free world controls less than 5% of the global drone market, close quote, he says from his office at Brink headquarters in Seattle, which overlooks lines of engineers in blue coats assembling responder charging nests. Quote, the end stage here is that we're the DJI of the West, close quote. A framed copy of the sanctions Beijing imposed on the company and on him personally hangs in his office. Last December, the Chinese banned Brink and Resnick, along with a dozen other companies, from conducting business with or traveling to China. Plus, Resnick had a hand in the impending DJI ban. Over the last 3 years, he spent $660,000 on lobbying, including for controls over the use of Chinese-made drones in the U.S. That's a huge amount of money for a deeply unprofitable company that booked just $5 million in sales last year, per Forbes estimates, and is on track for $15 million this year. But the payoff is potentially huge. Should the ban go ahead, quote, there will be an enormous amount of demand for us, close quote, says Resnick, whose estimated 40% share in Brink is now worth $192 million. China hawks in Congress fear DJI's tools could be used to send sensitive information on Americans back to Beijing though the company has long labeled that unfounded hearsay. Adam Welsh, head of global policy at DJI, said, quote, "The U.S. government has every right to strengthen national security measures, but this must go hand in hand with due process, fairness, and transparency," close quote. A la TikTok, the company is now asking the U.S. government to start a review of its tech or grant an extension. The Federal Communications Commission did not respond to repeated requests for comment. While it's not a top-of-the-line DJI, the Responder, which launched last year, is no clunker. From their nests, the drones can reach an emergency within a 2-mile radius in 70 seconds or less. A Responder, which is largely controlled remotely by officers, can fly up to 42 minutes on a full battery and needs just 35 minutes to recharge. Even with a population of less than 90,000, Queen Creek has kept its single Responder drone busy, since it became one of America's first police departments to try the drone in June. Its Responder has been sent on more than 450 missions: burglaries, sexual assaults, suicides, and shots fired. The Responder was first on the scene 131 times and handled 35 situations without an officer present for things like automatic, often false, car crash reports. Chief Randy Bryce says he plans to purchase an entire fleet. The department's older drones, primarily made by DJI, of course, are starting to collect dust. Quote, "We wanted to find an American-made item that wouldn't be hit by any type of prohibition," close quote, he says. Along with the Responder, which is made specifically for 911 calls, Brink also offers the Lemur, starting price $10,000, designed for indoor use by SWAT teams, and the Brink Ball, a $2,500 and up softball-sized communications device that can be thrown into scenarios in which making direct contact or delivering a cell phone is too difficult. Think hostage situations or natural disasters. So far, Brink has attracted more than 700 customers, mostly police departments, about 100 of which bought a Responder. Buyers range from small to medium-sized agencies, such as the Pueblo PD in Colorado, to the largest police agency in the U.S., the New York City Police Department. At the federal level, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, is a user. Brink's origins date to October 2017. A 17-year-old Resnick was at his childhood home in Las Vegas when a mass shooting occurred just 20 minutes away. A gunman had opened fire from his 32nd-floor hotel room on the Vegas Strip, targeting attendees of the Route 91 Harvest Festival. 58 people were killed, more than 400 were wounded. Resnick, who had built drones since he was 10 years old, wondered why the cops didn't use one in a situation like this. He bombarded the police department with requests for a meeting. Over coffee at a local Einstein Brothers Bagels, Lieutenant Will Hudler of the Las Vegas Metro Police Department listened skeptically as the gangly 6'3" teenager with a mop of frizzy brown hair insisted he could build a drone that was unlike any consumer drone out there, one with features specific to SWAT teams. Hudler decided to give the kid a chance, 90 days to build a prototype. Resnick went to work piecing together components, mostly made in China, on his parents' dining room table. On day 86, he demoed the device to 40 SWAT members. No good. One officer swiftly slapped it out of the air with a towel, proof enough that it wasn't ready for the real world. But Resnick didn't give up. Drones were an obsession. His latest after years of taking apart toys, then hair dryers, then microwaves. An early diagnosis of dyslexia worked in his favor when he was enrolled in extra classes. He skipped sixth grade, spent a year and a half in high school, and then headed to the University of Las Vegas at 14. Internships at McLaren and Tesla followed, then a transfer to Northwestern, where he studied mechanical engineering. He took a few months off to intern at DJI in Palo Alto, California, and saw firsthand how the global leader built flying machines. He never went back to school, dropping out in early 2017 to try his hand at making drones himself. 3 months after his humbling experience with the Vegas team, Resnick called back, this time with a drone that could write itself. Hudler, impressed, invited him to join the SWAT team for some ride-alongs, where he remembers squeezing, quote, "a tactical helmet over that beautiful head of hair," close quote. Together, Resnick and the Vegas SWAT team developed the Lemur, which would become his flagship drone. Brink, short for Blake Resnick, Inc., officially incorporated in 2018 with Vegas Metro as its first customer. For 2 years, Brink was a one-man operation. Then Resnick received $100,000 from the Thiel Fellowship, which gives entrepreneurial kids funds to skip college. Revenue hit $100,000 a year, but if Brink was going to scale, Resnick needed more capital. His savior came in the form of Sam Altman, the OpenAI CEO who was then a ravenous tech investor. In 2020, Resnick joined a call with a friend of a friend who was looking for investment opportunities. The acquaintance, who zoomed in shirtless and in bed, stopped Resnick mid-pitch to say he wasn't going to invest but would make introductions, including to a former romantic partner of Altman's. Shortly after, Altman emailed Resnick directly, asking about revenue, customers, use cases, growth rate, and how much he planned to raise. Resnick replied in a heartbeat. Quote, okay, I'd like to invest, close quote, Altman responded some 36 hours later. A $2 million check followed. Altman then brought in Scale AI's billionaire founder, Alexander Wang, for another $150,000. It really gave me much-needed capital and credibility, which I used to get our first headquarters and make our first hires, close quote. It also opened the door to his next much larger funding rounds, with Wang making the introduction to Blue Chip Firm Index, which led Brink's $25 million Series A in 2021, as well as its most recent $75 million round in April. Thiel invested a small amount in 2022, the same year Resnick made the Forbes 30 Under 30. Quote, he's a sponge, close quote, says index partner Vlad Lakhtev. Quote, realizing that there's still a lot to learn is very important, especially when someone starts a company so young, close quote. In his 22,000-square-foot Seattle facility, where Brink moved in 2021, Resnick forcefully shoves an airborne Lemur drone, pushing it to the ground in an echo of the Vegas PD's original test. It buzzes loudly like a giant mechanical bee as it rights itself and returns to eye level. On a handheld controller, there's a live feed from the drone's camera. Resnick dials a number into his phone, connecting directly to the Lemur thanks to one of Brink's partnerships with AT&T, T-Mobile, and Verizon. For his next trick, he shows how the Lemur can quickly shatter windows using a tip made of an extremely hard material that combines tungsten and carbon, scattering glass shards across the parking lot outside. Resnick spends little time in HQ these days. He travels 3 days a week, pitching police chiefs and mayors on the responder. Hudler sometimes goes too. Now retired from the Vegas PD, he's Brink's VP of Customer Success, training other cops to use its drones. Resnick estimates around 15% of SWAT teams in the U.S. currently use the Lemur, making it far and away Brink's most successful product. Some, though, don't believe Brink's devices compared to DJI's at all, especially when tested in more extreme environments. Kyle Nordfors of Utah's Mountain Rescue Association flies drones on SWAT missions and above the Rockies when climbers find themselves in peril. He says Brink devices aren't reliable, nimble, or quick enough to reach people in, quote, life or death, close quote, scenarios. Quote, DJI devices are just better in every way, close quote. Cops have had similar quibbles. Quote, range is definitely an issue, says Luis Figueredo, a police drone pilot from New Jersey who has flown the Lemur. The glass-breaking tool, he adds, quote, doesn't always work as intended, close quote. Even if DJI ends up banned, Brink is up against a major American competitor, San Mateo, California-based Skydio, which has raised over $730 million from venture capitalists, including Andreessen Horowitz, and has more than 1,000 public safety customers. ICE has spent $1.4 million on Skydio drones since 2021, compared to just $80,000 on Brink machines. The NYPD has 41 Skydio devices and 40 DJI drones in its fleet, and only 6 of Brink's. There's another clear market opportunity for Brink: defense. After Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, the company sent 60 Lemurs to Kiev to assist in search and rescue missions. But besides some exploratory meetings with Defense Department officials, Resnick didn't pursue any Pentagon contracts. Still, Brink's work in Ukraine has helped it understand how to make devices that work when radio frequency and GPS are constantly jammed. Brink's time in warfare may come, though. quote, I care about democracy existing, close quote, Resnick says. And if the U.S. were ever to go to war with China, it would be like those days after the music festival shooting. Resnick wouldn't be able to sit out the mission. Continuing in Forbes magazine, 30 under 30. AI is booming, and the revolutionaries on our 15th annual Forbes 30 under 30 list are all in. These young visionaries are harnessing machine learning to build robotic astronauts, cut off funding to terrorists, and craft powerful tools that let anyone be a genius coder or a master artist. While AI is new, the requirements to be a pioneering entrepreneur remain constant: imagination, intelligence, and plenty of grit. The honorees on this year's Forbes 30 Under 30 have these traits in spades and are using them to shape the future. To identify this exceptional group, Forbes editors, alongside expert independent judges, combed through more than 10,000 candidates, evaluating them on impact, financials, and scale. The result? 600 changemakers defining tomorrow. Next up in Forbes magazine, The New Nuclear Age by Chris Hellman and Phoebe Liu. Atomic energy is enjoying an unexpected comeback thanks to artificial intelligence's ravenous power demands, while a new crop of entrepreneurs seeks the favor and favoritism of the Trump administration. Many will fail, but the upside is nearly unlimited. At Allo Atomics, 40,000-square-foot factory on the south side of Austin, Texas, workers move 5/8-inch thick steel plates onto machines that slowly bend and roll them into 12-foot-wide cylinders, which they then weld into 25-foot-tall vessels. These could be made cheaper by outside contractors. But ALO co-founders and CEO Matt Losak wants to do this work in-house, since each vessel will eventually contain the guts of a 10-megawatt MW nuclear fission reactor. Five of these ALO-1 reactor units, working in tandem, will power a single 50-megawatt electric turbine, enough juice to run a large data processing center or 45,000 homes. Quote, it's not a paper reactor, it's getting built, close quote, declares Losak, a 35-year-old Canadian engineer now on his third startup. In August, ALO broke ground on a 2-acre site at the Department of Energy's Idaho National Laboratory, where it aims to achieve, quote-unquote, criticality by July 4, 2026. America's 250th birthday and the deadline President Donald Trump has set for at least three U.S. startups to prove that their advanced nuclear reactor designs work. To achieve criticality, ALO will load a vessel with off-the-shelf nuclear fuel rod assemblies and then initiate a self-sustaining nuclear fission chain reaction. Producing electricity? That comes later. Even after achieving criticality, ALO will still need to build out manufacturing and a supply chain of vendors, sign data center customers, and get final approval from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Quote, we'll get the factory set up, come down the cost curve, and have this holy grail product, close quote, vows Losak, who is shopping for up to 1 million square feet for a gigafactory and recently hired Bryson Gentile, who headed Falcon 9 manufacturing at Elon Musk's SpaceX, to set up ALO's mass production operation. Quote, what Elon did with electric cars and rockets was kind of like running the 4-minute mile. When that happens, everyone's like, wait, this is possible, Losak says. He hopes to produce electricity in 2027. Demand for electricity is soaring, largely because of the power-sucking data centers undergirding the artificial intelligence boom, and Losak isn't the only nuclear entrepreneur aiming to ride the wave of AI dollars. A dozen ventures with names like Valor Atomics, Oklo, Kairos Power, and X Energy are racing to perfect, permit, and deploy a new generation of small prefabricated reactors that could power individual data centers or even feed the larger electrical grid. So far in 2025, venture capitalists, stock market investors, billionaires, the DOE, and others have poured more than $4 billion into these and other new U.S. nuclear ventures versus closer to $500 million in 2020 per PitchBook. Tens of billions more will be needed if nuclear power is to make a comeback. Two-year-old ALO has raised $136 million, $100 million of that in August, with billionaire Antonio Gracias' Valor Equity Partners as its lead backer. Balor was one of Tesla's first institutional investors, and Gracias, who sits on SpaceX's board, told Forbes that Halo will be a winner because of its commitment to manufacturing and vertical integration, quote, similar to Tesla's first principles approach to batteries, electric vehicles, and robotics, close quote. These startups won't all succeed, but the stars seem aligned for nuclear energy's comeback. Demand is there. OpenAI's Sam Altman has said he'll need an outlandish 250 gigawatts of power in 8 years. That's as much as Brazil uses. More sober analysts predict that by 2030, data centers will need double the roughly 40 gigawatts they now consume. At the current average industrial electricity price of 9 cents per kilowatt hour, 40 gigawatts would cost $32 billion a year, but prices will rise if demand grows faster than generating capacity. Analysts see natural gas turbines filling maybe 60% of the need, but those are on 4-year back order. Coal remains unpopular, no matter how often Trump refers to the dirtiest fossil fuel as, quote, beautiful and clean, close quote. Wind and solar, besides being on Trump's hit list, don't provide the sort of 24/7 reliability data centers require. That's a big gap for nuclear startups to fill. Quote, there is plenty of room for everyone to do well because the world needs that much energy and more, close quote, says Iran-born billionaire Kamal Ghaffarian, the aerospace entrepreneur who is the founder of Rockville, Maryland-based X Energy, which is developing a gas-cooled nuclear reactor. Sure, lots of folks still oppose nuclear reactors, particularly in their own backyard, but support is now both broad-based and top-down. Since reoccupying the Oval Office in January, Trump has canceled giant offshore wind projects, scotched a solar mega farm, and signed the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, killing tax credits for wind and solar power projects that begin construction after next July 4th. But that same law preserved and expanded benefits for nuclear power. Tax credits for new designs now equal up to 40% of investment. The Trump administration is also overhauling the famously slow and cautious Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which should speed up approval of new designs. And it aims to make permitting easier, in part by encouraging startups to locate reactors on military bases or at sites like the Idaho National Lab that have hosted nuclear activity since World War II's Manhattan Project. While Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates has been singing nuclear energy's praises as an answer to global warming for 2 decades, other voices now join the chorus. People say, quote, if we invented nuclear fission today, we would view it as the silver bullet that solves climate change, close quote, says Drew Wanzelak, a principal at venture capitalist firm Alumni Ventures, which invested in X Energy, Halo, and Valor. Quote, that's how powerful it is, close quote. Back at Halo, Lozak and his co-founder, Chief Technology Officer Yasser Arafat, 39, have added personal reasons for pursuing a nuclear revival. Lozak's childhood asthma abated after his home province, Ontario, replaced nearby coal-burning plants with nuclear ones. Arafat did his calculus homework by candlelight in Bangladesh before coming to the U.S. as a college student and earning a master's in nuclear engineering from North Carolina State. His career has spanned the scale. He worked on Westinghouse's big AP1000, an 1,100-megawatt reactor, before heading to Idaho National Lab in 2019 to lead microreactor design. The co-founders hope eventually to sell their small mass-produced reactors not only to AI firms, but also to poor, power-starved countries. Halo means the light in Bengali. Not so long ago, the future of nuclear energy looked grim. After a tsunami led to disaster at Japan's Fukushima nuclear plant in 2011, both Japan and Germany began mothballing sites. The U.S. industry, for its part, had been struggling since the partial meltdown at Pennsylvania's Three Mile Island in 1979. The accident dominated headlines for months, but the small amount of radiation released turned out to pose no threat, the NRC says. Nevertheless, the regulatory fallout from Three Mile Island led to plant cancellations and stricter NRC rules, contributing to delays and runaway costs for big nuclear plants. In 2024, after 15 years, Georgia Power finally completed its Augusta, Georgia plant with 2 Westinghouse AP1000 reactors capable of powering 1.7 million houses. The cost surpassed $30 billion, more than double the original budget, reportedly due to unproven engineering, non-existent supply chains, and a skilled worker shortage. Building a plant of equivalent size with natural gas turbines, assuming they could be found, would cost just $7 billion. It seemed the U.S. no longer had the ability to construct big nuclear plants efficiently. It now has 94 operating grid-scale reactors, many over 40 years old, down from 112 in 1990. DOE, Gates, and other true believers were already pouring money into new reactor designs when Russia's February 2022 invasion of Ukraine and AI's voracious power demands jump-started the nuclear bandwagon. The European Union, desperate to wean itself off Russian oil and gas, decided that zero-carbon nuclear power can be considered green in some cases. Meta, Amazon, and Alphabet's Google have all inked long-term deals to buy nuke juice. Even Three Mile Island is back in the game. Its surviving reactor, closed in 2019, is now being prepped for restart after Microsoft agreed to buy all its output for the next 20 years. It's been renamed the Crane Clean Energy Center. At 40, Mike Laufer, CEO and co-founder of Kairos Power, is a new nuke veteran, having already built, operated, and decommissioned a demonstration plant in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Quote, "In 9 years, we've learned a huge amount," close quote, he says. Kairos is now building Hermes 1, its first power-generating demonstration reactor, as well as Hermes 2, its first commercial reactor, which aims to deliver 50 megawatts to the Tennessee Valley Authority's electric grid by 2030. Google has agreed to buy, by 2035, some 500 megawatts of power from Hermes reactors. Kairos' headquarters is in a converted aircraft hangar at the former Naval Air Station in Alameda, California, just south of UC Berkeley, where Laufer and his two co-founders got their doctorates. The startup expects $303 million in funding from DOE by the time it completes Hermes 1 in 2028. Laufer refuses to say whether his billionaire father, Henry Laufer, a mathematician who built hedge fund pioneer Renaissance Technologies with the late Jim Simons, is a backer. The prefabricated modular Kairos system capitalizes on decades of advances with a molten fluoride salt-cooled reactor design. It uses a novel quote-unquote pebble fuel known as TRISO, T-R-I-S-O, which stands for tri-structural isotropic. This fuel is a feature of several new reactor designs and a big reason why backers claim the new systems are both meltdown and terrorist-proof. Tiny uranium dioxide kernels, the size of poppy seeds, are coated in millimeter-thick layers that insulate the uranium and contain dangerous fission products. Kairos then encases the TRISO in graphite to form pebbles the size of golf balls. When a lot of these pebbles are close together, they can initiate fission reactions, yet the multi-layered coatings aim to prevent the fuel from ever getting hot enough to initiate a runaway chain reaction or meltdown. Backers claim that even if bad guys stole the thousands of TRISO pebbles in a mini-reactor, they'd be hard-pressed to do anything dangerous with them. And if they blew up a reactor, a cleanup crew would be able to go in after and safely pick up the pebbles. Kairos has devised its own TRISO production line, which is now being moved to DOE's Los Alamos National Lab site, so it can finally, quote-unquote, pelletize actual enriched uranium. Quote, "In-house manufacturing is a key part of our strategy," close quote, Laufer says. Isaiah Taylor, the 26-year-old founder and CEO of two-year-old Valor Atomics, also plans to use TRISO fuel, but isn't producing it himself yet. He's too busy developing what Steve Marcus of Los Angeles-based Riot Ventures, which seeded Valor, describes as, quote, "the Toyota Corolla of reactors, not a Lamborghini," close quote. In September, the El Segundo, California-based startup broke ground in Utah on its first demonstration reactor. In November, Valor announced a $130 million funding round and said it had achieved zero power criticality, fission but no electricity, in a test of its reactor core at Los Alamos. It's not clear if zero power criticality meets Trump's goal. Regardless, Taylor expects to achieve full reactor criticality, generating electricity, that is, by the president's July 4th deadline, with his quote-unquote Ward 250 high-temperature gas-cooled reactor design named after his grandfather, Ward Shapp, a scientist on the Manhattan Project. Valor has already built a thermal prototype that gets subjected to the same operational temperatures and pressures, but without the uranium fuel inside. Quote, we dump 16 city blocks of LA power, half a megawatt, into the core, close quote, says Taylor, whose team has discovered leaks and learned valuable skills by repeatedly taking their prototype apart and putting it back together. Taylor, who is a member of this year's Forbes 30 Under 30, is a man in a hurry. The Idaho native dropped out of high school at 16 and spent what would have been his college years teaching himself nuclear engineering. His gung-ho attitude appeals to both funders and MAGA influencers. Quote, he has the unique ability to be persuasive and get people to join the mission, close quote, Marcus says. Fittingly, another Valor investor is Palmer Luckey, the billionaire who was featured on Forbes 30 Under 30 list in 2014, sold his virtual reality firm Oculus to Meta when he was just 21 and co-founded high-tech weapons maker Anduril at 24. This year, Valor joined a lawsuit filed against the NRC claiming it was taking too long to permit new nukes and might not have the authority to regulate many reactors anyway. Other plaintiffs in the case are startups Last Energy and Deep Fission, plus Texas, Utah, Louisiana, Florida, and the Arizona legislature. The case has been stayed for settlement talks. Quote, we need nuclear now, close quote, not after a three-year review process, says Deep Fission CEO Liz Miller, 47, who founded the startup with her father, a retired UC Berkeley physics professor. The two-year-old startup raised $30 million in a September public offering. Its unusual approach involves boring a 30-inch diameter hole a mile down into the earth, lowering a uranium fuel containment canister into it, and filling the hole with water, which will be heated by the reactor to generate power, while keeping the reactor safely ensconced in solid rock. Quote, over the next 2 years, we're going to see who can actually start to build and who can't, close quote, Mueller said. One startup that has cashed in on the hype without even building a pilot plant is Oklo, founded in 2013 by husband and wife Jacob and Caroline DeWitt. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman was its chairman from 2015 until April. The company went public via a SPAC in 2024, and its market cap of $15 billion, down from a $26 billion peak in October, makes both DeWitt's billionaires. While Oklo has begun prep work on a site adjacent to Idaho National Lab, it's unlikely to reach criticality by next July 4th. Still, it has friends in high places. Energy Secretary Chris Wright was formerly on Oklo's board. It's the highest profile of a half dozen publicly traded mini-nuke companies. Quote, Oklo's stock is very symbolic of what public opinion is. Everybody's pro-nuclear and wants to be invested in it, close quote, Riot's Marcus says. It's worth noting that even the wealthiest, most intelligent, and most powerful people on the planet can't just will a new reactor into being. Bill Gates co-founded TerraPower in 2008. After 17 years and close to $4 billion in investment from Gates, DEO, NVIDIA, HD Hyundai, and others, it still doesn't have the NRC's approval for its 350-megawatt molten salt reactor design. There's also a chance, particularly given Trump's constant flip-flopping, that old-fashioned big nuclear plants, not factory-built units, could be the future. Having gone through bankruptcy and multiple ownership changes in the past decade, Westinghouse received a fresh lifeline in October when the Trump administration pledged to help expedite permitting and financing for $80 billion in new reactors, enough to build anywhere from 5 to 10 Westinghouse AP1000s, in exchange for Uncle Sam taking a 20% quote-unquote participation interest in any Westinghouse profits above $17.5 billion generated by 2029. That's terrific news for Amarillo, Texas-based Fermi America, which has minted the richest new nuclear billionaire, co-founder and CEO Toby Neugebauer, who is 53 years old. A private equity investor and son of a former Republican congressman, Neugebauer and his family saw their net worth hit $6 billion after Fermi went public in October. Fermi's plan is to build colossal data centers powered by at least four AP1000 reactors on 5,000 acres adjacent to Pantex, a Department of Energy outpost in the Texas Panhandle that for decades has manufactured the plutonium heart of nuclear warheads. Quote, if you can't build nuclear power on this site, you can't do it anywhere, close quote, says Neugebauer, whose co-founders are Rick Perry, the former governor of Texas and Trump's first energy secretary, and Perry's son, Griffin. Neugebauer is a project developer, not an innovator. He has hired as his chief nuclear construction officer, Mesut Özman, a Turkey-born U.S. citizen who helped manage the building of the first four AP1000 reactors in China, then another in Bulgaria, and four more in the UAE. Quote, we have someone who is not a virgin. He's got 13 kisses under his belt, close quote, brags Neugebauer, who says that once the small nuclear reactor guys are ready, he'll happily build multiple gigawatts of them on the site, too. Neugebauer is also hedging his nuclear bet. He already has 2.5 gigawatts of natural gas turbines on order and intends to build 11 gigawatts of gas power before his first reactor is complete. But his long-term vision is for Amarillo to serve as the federal government's hub for atomic-powered artificial intelligence. Quote, the reason we do nuclear is we are patriots, close quote, he says. Quote, China is building 33 large reactors, not for air conditioning. They are building power out the wazoo. That's why we need nuclear AI, close quote. Now we turn to Barron's. Three reasons Rocket Lab's stock is headed to the moon. The space launch and technology company is poised to build on Friday's big gain in Monday trading. Rocket Lab's stock is ending 2025 on a roll. Shares of the space launch and technology company were up 4.6% in pre-market trading at $73.78, while S&P 500 and Dow Jones Industrial Average futures were up to 0.4% and 0.1% respectively. The Monday move comes after an 18% jump on Friday, leaving shares up 177% so far in 2025. A couple of things helped on Friday. For starters, there was an $816 million contract award from the U.S. Space Development Agency, Rocket Lab's largest single award to date. The company will design and manufacture 18 satellites for the Tracking Layer Tranche 3 program under the proliferated warfighter space architecture, the U.S. Space Force's network of small satellites in low Earth orbit. Stifel analyst Eric Rasmussen raised his price target to $85 from $75 following the award. He rates shares as buy. Overall, 67% of analysts covering Rocket Lab's stock rate the shares at buy, according to FactSet. The average buy rating ratio for stocks in the S&P 500 is about 55%. The average analyst price target for Rocket Lab shares is about $71. It started the year at about $23. Along with new business, President Trump issued an executive order on Thursday to ensure, quote, American space superiority, close quote. Some of his goals are to return to the moon by 2028, establish a lunar outpost, and increase investment in the sector. That is good news for all space technology stocks, including Rocket Lab. Topping it off was Rocket Lab's 21st launch of the year on Sunday, extending its record total for 2025. The mission was for the Institute for Kyushu Pioneers of Space, a Japan-based Earth imaging company. It's been quite a year for Rocket Lab and its stock. They are entering 2026 with significant momentum. Continuing in Barron's, Disney's Avatar, Fire and Ash, falls short of domestic box office sales expectations. The third installment of James Cameron's fantasy adventure about the Blue Navi people raked in $88 million across 3,800 screens in the U.S. and Canada. Walt Disney and 20th Century Studios' Avatar: Fire and Ash splashed to the top of the global box office with an estimated $345 million weekend haul, but its domestic take fell short of analysts' expectations. The third installment of James Cameron's fantasy adventure about the Blue Navi people raked in $88 million across 3,800 screens in the U.S. and Canada, but analysts had been anticipating domestic sales of $110 million to $135 million. Roth senior research analyst Eric Handler wrote last week that Avatar: Fire and Ash was expected to kick off a strong rally in the final 2 weeks of the fourth quarter with a projected $110 million opening weekend. Hollywood is under pressure to achieve $9 billion in box office sales for the year, a goal that seems to be in doubt. Handler expects fourth quarter domestic box office sales to fall short of estimates, noting that the quarter is on track to finish down, quote, at least mid-single digits, close quote. Moviegoers shelled out an estimated nearly $178.7 million over the weekend, drawn by many new releases during the all-important holiday season, including the latest Avatar. Comscore's head of marketplace trends, Paul Durgarabedian, said with the industry's estimated nearly $8.4 million in domestic box office through Sunday, up 1% from this point in 2024, the potential for $9 billion remains. Quote, there are 10 more days in the box office year starting on Monday, and we are about $600 million away, close quote, from that threshold, he said. The sheer number of films opening this week and strong holdovers, including Avatar, make this one of the most packed seasons in box office history. But Handler is skeptical. Quote, in order to achieve our full quarter estimate of $2.5 billion, close quote, or plus 7% year over year, Hollywood would need gross ticket sales of more than $965 million over the last 2 weeks of the year, or, quote, a highly improbable 59%, close quote, year-over-year growth, he wrote. This weekend's four new wide-release films ensured there was, quote, something for everyone at the multiplex, close quote, Durgarabedian said. Angel Studios' David, a PG-rated animated family musical starring Assam Chaudhry, opened in second place at the domestic box office with $22 million. It was the best three-day theatrical opening in Angel history, surpassing Sound of Freedom's $19.6 million opening in 2023, and is the highest-grossing faith-based animated theatrical opening of all time, Comscore said. Lionsgate's The Housemaid, an R-rated thriller based on the best-selling book and starring Sydney Sweeney and Amanda Seyfried, debuted in third place with $19.0 million. Paramount Pictures, the SpongeBob movie Search for SquarePants, SpongeBob's fourth PG-rated animated adventure, opened in fourth place with $16 million. In fifth place, Disney's Zootopia 2 sold another $14.5 million in its fourth weekend, bringing its domestic cumulative take through Sunday to $282.8 million. Over 4 weekends, the animated film has grossed an estimated nearly $1.3 billion worldwide. And A24's Marty Supreme, the R-rated drama starring Timothée Chalamet and Gwyneth Paltrow, sold out 92 shows for $875,000, despite playing in only 6 theaters in New York and Los Angeles, taking in a record per-screen average of $145,833, the highest price since 2016's La La Land. Marty Supreme opens in wide release on Christmas, along with Sony Pictures' Anaconda and Focus Features' Song Sung Blue. Avatar: Fire and Ash, a 3-hour, 17-minute film about Jake and Neytiri's family facing off against a new aggressive Na'vi tribe called the Ash People, stars Sigourney Weaver, Sam Worthington, Zoe Saldana, and Stephen Lang. It sold $257 million internationally through Sunday, and studios are hoping it ignites another $2 billion-plus worldwide movie-going phenomenon. The first Avatar film, released in 2009, grossed $785.2 million in domestic box office ticket sales and more than $2.9 billion worldwide, with 73% of its gross ticket sales outside the U.S. and Canada, according to Box Office Mojo. It clocked in at 2 hours, 42 minutes. Avatar: The Way of Water, the 2022 follow-up, grossed $688.5 million at the domestic box office and $2.3 billion worldwide, with 71% of ticket sales outside the U.S. and Canada. The sequel was 3 hours 12 minutes long. Steve Buck, chief strategy officer for Entelligence, noted that Avatar: The Way of Water's opening weekend drew 8.7 million people and 85% of the national audience in December 2022. In comparison, Avatar: Fire and Ash drew only 5.2 million people and 45% of national foot traffic because it was competing with David, 14% of the movie-going audience, The Housemaid, 12%, The SpongeBob Movie, 9%, and Zootopia, 8%. Avatar: Fire and Ash also sold $43.6 million in global IMAX tickets. It made its debut across 1,703 IMAX screens worldwide in the widest global IMAX release of all time, becoming the third highest ever international IMAX debut and the fifth biggest debut in IMAX history. Handler says that it could gross about $160 million for IMAX by the end of the year, up from the $151 million Avatar: The Way of Water grossed in the fourth quarter of 2022. He attributed much of the projected differential between the two titles to the higher screen count for the latest film. Dugara Bedian said that many of Avatar's screenings are in 3D or premium formats, which is a major selling point of the film's success globally and will provide a boost to January 2026 box office sales. Quote, "The Avatar films have historically been marathon runners, not sprinters," close quote, saying the 2009 film played for nearly a year in theaters, and 2022's Avatar: The Way of Water played for 6 months consecutively in movie theaters in the U.S. and Canada, he said. "Any movie that runs over 3 hours means fewer available showtimes a day," quote, "thus making its $88 million debut pretty darn impressive," close quote, he added. Dugara Bedian told Barron's that, quote, "more importantly, 2026 is shaping up to be the biggest domestic box office year since the pandemic, with an incredible slate of blockbuster films, including the recently announced Spielberg film Disclosure Day and Tom Cruise's new film Digger, now set for release next year." And now moving to Fortune magazine. McKinsey alums dominate the world's C-suites. Will AI dry up the firm's CEO pipeline? By Ruth Umo. 4 years ago, Citigroup CEO Jane Fraser shattered Wall Street's glass ceiling to become the first woman to lead one of the big four U.S. banks. But long before taking the helm of the $2.6 trillion financial institution, Fraser was honing a skill set that would quietly define her ascent. One forged not just in the corridors of high finance, but also inside the high-pressure, hyper-analytical halls of the world's most famous consulting firm. Fraser joined McKinsey in 1994, fresh from Harvard Business School, and a superpower she learned there was, quote, "problem structuring," close quote. As a young consultant, cycling through boardrooms and back offices, Fraser was trained to break down sprawling challenges, design transformation roadmaps, and rally teams across silos. By the time she made partner in 1997, at the age of 30, she had advised multinational corporations on everything from growth strategy to crisis recovery. It was a crash course in decision-making and pattern recognition across a range of industries. Quote, "you learn to structure issues from the ground up, to define what success looks like, and to pull the right people together to get there," close quote, Fraser says. Quote, "that way of thinking has never left me," close quote. Fraser left McKinsey in 2004 to join Citigroup. The skills she developed in consulting didn't apply immediately, but over time they became central to her executive playbook. A methodical, systems-driven approach to fixing what's broken, reimagining what can be achieved, and scaling what works, Fraser rotated through critical roles, often in battered businesses, from private banking to Citigroup's mortgage unit after the housing crash. When she was tapped to lead Citigroup Latin America in 2015, she inherited a franchise still dealing with fallout from a major fraud scandal and in need of a cultural and risk management overhaul. Each assignment sharpened her instincts as a fixer and strategist. By the time she ascended to CEO, Fraser brought more than financial fluency, she says. She brought a horizontal approach to leadership, a comfort with ambiguity, and a knack for breaking the messiest problems into solvable parts, the muscle memory of McKinsey. Fraser is hardly an outlier. Across corporate America, McKinsey-trained executives occupy a remarkable number of corner offices. The firm counts at least 18 current Fortune 500 CEOs among its alumni, more than any other company, including Alphabet's Sundar Pichai, DoorDash's Tony Zhu, Lockheed Martin's James Taiclet, and Visa's Ryan McInerney. Add the Fortune Global 500, and that list jumps to 28, with names like Novartis's Vaz Narasimhan and Allianz's Alibaba Bhatt. McKinsey says its internal data shows that more than 500 alumni have held C-suite roles at current Global 500 companies since McKinsey's founding. More than 700 currently hold such roles at companies with more than $300 million in annual revenue. And stunningly, more than half of its alumni over age 40 have reached the C-suite. Those numbers may not be a result of deliberate strategy, but they didn't accrue by accident. For decades, McKinsey has positioned itself as a finishing school for future leaders, where raw talent is shaped through intensity, repetition, and exposure to high-stakes decision-making. The result, when it works, is accelerated judgment and a boldness in imagining ambitious solutions. Quote, you start to believe that more is possible, close quote, says Liz Hilton Siegel, a senior partner and McKinsey lifer. Quote, you build pattern recognition that comes from helping a client do something they didn't think was even achievable, and that builds confidence you carry forever, close quote. The work is demanding, but the payoff has historically been clear, a fast track to influence. And unlike firms that lose track of talent after the exit interview, McKinsey keeps its alumni close. Through invite-only summits, mentorship programs, and informal back channels, it has built one of the most powerful self-reinforcing networks in global business, maintaining relationships long after consultants leave the company and often re-engaging them as clients or collaborators on the other side of the table. But there's no guarantee that this pipeline can replenish itself forever. As with General Electric, a once prolific CEO factory whose dominance has since waned, the question now is whether McKinsey's golden age as a corporate kingmaker can endure, especially as artificial intelligence reshapes the very foundation of consulting. The firm that once trained future executives by immersing them in the world's toughest business problems now faces a future where algorithms are taking on part of the work. Benchmarking, research synthesis, and even PowerPoint creation, once the province of junior consultants, are increasingly automated. That shift is forcing McKinsey and other consultancies to rethink their talent models and their value proposition. No longer reliant on a steady stream of fresh MBAs, McKinsey is hiring more seasoned operators, established leaders who know how to plan for technology-driven change and see it through. At the same time, the Fortune 500's leadership archetype is evolving. Boards are prioritizing executives with deep technical fluency and a proficiency for developing great products and who have led organizations through the messy realities of digital transformation. Historically, McKinsey's alumni have been most concentrated in sectors where its problem structuring muscle mattered most, finance, healthcare, and industrials. Across the Fortune 500 and Global 500, roughly a third of alumni CEOs sit in banking, insurance, and payments, with another sizable share in healthcare and life sciences. Where McKinsey's footprint thins is just as telling. In big tech, the marquee names are few, Pichai and Zhu. Absent are alumni in the top job at Apple, Amazon, Meta, or Microsoft, a cohort that's steadily defining the future of the global economy. That's not coincidental. These firms often elevate leaders who came up through engineering or product ranks and whose credibility comes from building and scaling platforms rather than analyzing them. The strategist CEO, long synonymous with McKinsey, now competes with a rising class of tech-native leaders, many of whom have never set foot in a consulting firm. Still, writing off McKinsey would be premature. The firm, which turns 100 next year, has weathered tectonic shifts before, from the rise of globalization to the digital revolution. McKinsey doesn't just advise companies, the firm says. It teaches people to think in systems, dissect complexity, and lead decisively. The real test is whether that model can evolve fast enough to stay relevant in an AI-powered economy. In the past 18 months, McKinsey has trimmed 10% of its global workforce, largely through attrition and tougher performance management thresholds. The move is being described as a strategic reset, but the scale is large enough to suggest more than mere belt tightening. The firm that helped define corporate leadership must now prove it can produce a new kind of CEO, not just strategists, but architects of transformation. If it can, its grip on the C-suite may endure. If not, McKinsey's legacy as a CEO factory may give way to a new center of gravity that's built in code, not in conference rooms. Inside McKinsey's lower Manhattan offices, one meeting room stands apart. It's a replica of former managing partner Ron Daniel's corner office, a tribute to the man who helped turn McKinsey into a leadership factory. Daniel, who spent 66 years at the firm and was an advisor to the likes of Jamie Dimon and Michael Bloomberg, continued coming into the office well into his 90s before passing away in 2023. It was under his tenure as global managing partner from 1976 to 1988 that McKinsey leaned into its identity as a breeding ground for top execs. Now the firm is reasserting that legacy with new urgency. Quote, "We are creating lots of leaders," close quotes, says Bob Sternfels, McKinsey's global managing partner, the firm's CEO equivalent. Quote, "But is it random, or is there something in the formula and the method?" Close quote. That question is now central to McKinsey's effort to rethink its leadership development model. Sternfels believes the answer lies in a, quote, "diverse meritocracy," close quote, a system that lowers the drawbridge to a broader talent pool while raising the bar for performance once inside. Quote, "It's far less about credentials and far more about potential and raw intrinsics," close quote, he says. Quote, "If you're good enough, you should feel like you have a shot," close quote. And that shot comes quickly. New consultants are thrust into stretch roles, steeped in feedback and expected to develop at speed. Under McKinsey's infamous quote-unquote upper-out model, consultants must make partner, on average, within 6 years or leave the firm. Most leave within a few years, often for prominent roles in business, public service, and entrepreneurship. The firm's 3,000 partners face equally high expectations. Each year, a review committee assesses how partners lead, perform with clients, and contribute to teams, conducting 20 to 30 interviews per partner, says senior partner Daniel Packfitt, a member of the panel. Yet that rigor is paired with reflection. Packfitt often encourages colleagues to consider outside opportunities, not to push them out, he says, but to sharpen their sense of purpose. Sternfels shares this view, noting that he wants employees to continuously, quote-unquote, re-enroll in their McKinsey career. Quote, "In some ways, I don't care how long you stay," close quote, he says. Quote, "What matters is whether you have unrivaled development while you're here," close quote. As client demands evolve and leadership grows more complex, McKinsey is betting that the best way to remain indispensable is to double down on its people. Still, the growth is self-authored. Partners have no direct bosses. They're expected to chart their own course, build their own portfolios, define their value, and maintain lasting relationships with clients. That course very often leads to a corner office. McKinsey tracks the arc of its alumni, and an astounding number of them go on to lead companies. Among those now over 50, about 13% of those who left as entry-level analysts have been CEO of a company at some point in their careers, a figure that represents nearly 1,200 people. Among the much smaller group who attained a senior partner badge, more than half became CEOs. For all the resources McKinsey pours into leadership development, many of its most prominent alumni are quick to clarify that the firm was a powerful springboard to the CEO role, but not the whole story. The corner office came only after years spent building operating muscle elsewhere. Quote, "McKinsey has been everything for me," close quote, says Visa CEO Ryan McInerney, who joined the firm straight out of college. From the start, he says, the firm offered him rare proximity to power and a front-row seat to how decisions get made. In the late 90s and early 2000s, his anchor clients were Bank One and Visa. At Bank One, then a troubled institution, McInerney got to work directly with its new CEO, Jamie Dimon. You've been listening to Down to Business. My name's Greg Conroy. This has been brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization, helping the low vision and blind communities in the St. Louis region since 1973. Have a great week. Take care.